This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
So the ideas in this paper, still a work in progress really, are grounded in and are emerged from my approach to doing anthropology and art in the wake of the triple disaster which happened in Japan in 2011. And here I'm approaching art as on speaking terms with research, or specifically social research, and therefore approaching art as a work of translation rather than representation. This is expanded on in lots of different ways in other places, but just briefly to explain that it was only in the Middle Ages where translation or translatio became more narrowly identified with linguistics. So the prior, more broader sense was metaphorical and related to processes of transformation, to movements or transfers of persons, ideas and objects, including from medium to medium, as well as from experience to text. And of course, in anthropology, there's a rich tradition of looking at that. For example, Assad, who compares translation to history in order to refer to both being and being represented. But my primary aim in this paper is to present the crux of my alternative theorization of an apocalyptic sublime, drawing a crucial distinction between an imminent, with an I, and an immanent apocalypse, which I'll explore, or I'll touch on in relation to nuclear radiation and the definition of a hyperobject. Indeed, the very definition of a hyperobject, according to Timothy Morton. Ultimately, it's part of my effort to explore alternatives to the dominant and often paralyzing discourses of disaster. And it's also an attempt to engage questions that might be considered metaphysical as well as methodologically experimental. In the short paper today, I don't have time to discuss works of art or art practice in great detail, but reflecting on some of that, alongside the work of other artists, at the very end, I'm going to move through aspects of just one process, cyanotype printmaking, which was part of an accreting series of exhibitions I've called Invisible Matters. And as you'll see, I hope it's not to illustrate the concept, but rather to open it up. Okay. On the 11th of March 2011, the triple disaster, an earthquake, tsunami and nuclear meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, has come to be called 311, and it devastated the Tohoku region of northeast Japan, which you can see parts of here. The earthquake and tsunami left over 19,000 people dead. Thousands more were missing or injured, with over 340,000 displaced from their homes. Hundreds of thousands of buildings were destroyed or collapsed. And as a coastal and rural region, many livelihoods connected to fishing and agricultural production were just obliterated overnight. Many communities, 110,000 people, in fact, were officially evacuated. Many more voluntarily evacuated, in other words, without the support of the government, and continued to do so over the months that followed, as concerns about the dangerous levels of radiation and subsequent explosions became to have a greater impact. Now, serious concerns have been raised about the management of the disaster, not only that immediate aftermath, but also the explanations for it, involving bad planning, neglect, accusations of corruption, and the nuclear village, who we can understand as the pro-nuclear power policy community, electricity companies, nuclear scientists, state bureaucrats, basically are seen as avoiding both past responsibility and future accountability. And indeed, TEPCO, the main company responsible for Daiichi, was ultimately absolved of any responsibility and is now further protected by new secret state laws that make the information concerning nuclear plants classified. In my experience, few Japanese people believe or trust those corporate and political systems that do continue to claim things are under control, that workers... However, workers, as well as the consumers of nuclear energy, are in some sense complicit in this ongoing issue, mired in criticisms of incompetence, mendacity and corruption. Just to give you a sense of it. But Japan, of course, is notoriously statist, both in terms of their state bureaucracy in relation to economic development, but also the normative powers in moulding social organisations and the idea of what's happening. In the post-disaster environment, first, this rhetoric of crisis, or kiki, was very quickly amalgamated into a different logic, an idea that the disaster represented a kind of turning point, and therefore the possibility for renewal or revitalization. And so the language within Japan tended to employ the idea of gambare, to fight, to continue, and in slogans used by the media and the government, this gambare nippon was a really major theme. Though I should note that Japanese anthropologists have quite widely criticized the nationalist agendas implied by that. because in effect it means turning away from the local communities, which they argue is necessary for recovery. But the reason I mention this is because there's a sense of pressure of jishuku, which is self-censorship and self-restraint. And this is experienced as a kind of explicit and implicit gagging order. And part of this is the downplaying of risks, specifically around nuclear radiation's effect on food, for example. The Food Sanitation Act at the time of the disaster had no particular standards regarding radiation contamination. And after it happened, the government manipulated the radiation exposure limits. And it's still a subject of ongoing confusion. So there was the pre-disaster standard, and then there's different standards for staff. There are standards that they state publicly are not hazardous and so on. And so there's this strong sense of not quite knowing what the effects or the impacts might be, that spread of radiation. And in fact, even the impact in Fukushima itself, they only tested 350 sites from 97,000. And so degrees of contamination and knowledge about that vary. And nuclear radiation is actually used to illustrate the notion of a hyper-object. Timothy Morton is a kind of environmental or ecological theorist who talks about climate change and a kind of a different kind of ecological philosophy. And for him, a hyper-object is an object with a very long finitude, something which is massively distributed in time and space. It deflates biblical time scales, which is important for my later argument, and opens up the questions around deep time, something even more possibly than geological time. And for Morton, with this cultural bent, what matters is that the hyperobject breaks this aesthetic, the aesthetic that separates the viewer from the viewed, the effects of distance, the idea that we might be able to make an image of something like a hyperobject. Though I should say it's a very interesting area where, you know, big data science attempting to transform data into visualizations and so on, which all include a kind of excessiveness. Hyperobjects are often described as sticky, and it's a kind of something which can't quite be managed or held onto. They can't be exhausted by the perception of them. So back to Japan. Given Japan's dramatic history of natural disaster and environmental pollution, not cultural as well as scientific responses are necessary in order to facilitate dialogue, if not consensus, about what's happening there. In such a politically and socially conservative country, artists very recently, and this is a change I think, are opening up spaces for protest and critique of these systems, and in some senses, creative solutions. So some art historians and critics are suggesting that the disaster eventually became a kind of, or allowed the reemergence of a socially engaged visual culture. And in terms of art history, a break with particular aesthetic concerns that had dominated up to that point. I can't give a review of the ways in which it's been done, but they are often quite exclamatory. So people going in with hazmat suits into the exclusion zone or making exhibitions which can't be seen. So that kind of immediate response often kind of mirrors the visions of disaster which we see in international media. Here, before I move on, I'm just going to suggest some examples of artists who I met or worked with who are doing something slightly different. The next image, just to give you some context, was the Yuriage of the place before and after, which is quite a common type of image. And this, you won't be able to see it quite well, but this was a photograph I took. And there's a story behind this. When I first went in 2014 to look at these stricken sites, as they're called, and in effect, creating these sort of sublime images of landscapes that were entirely stricken, as they said, or it was hard to find a way of representing the particular landscapes and people without kind of venturing into that realm. But other artists who have done other sorts of things, for example, burying materials in the ground, and the nuclear radiation transforms the material itself. This image I included just because it reminded me so much of one you showed yesterday about hanging images. And I've got a series of exhibitions I did was all about postcards. Postcards were one of the only ways in which people could communicate with each other in the immediate aftermath. So there's another series of exhibitions through that. A flower artist who wrote poems and did sort of performative installations with natural materials. These kind of creatures wearing gas masks, which you can't see there. Or indeed the work of Aono Fumiaki, who I promised to show. This is part of a series called Mending Restoration, where Aono-san looked for pictures, found the remnants of objects, and I really wish I could talk a little bit more through this to see the ways in which he created these quite poetic hybrids of objects, in this case a lorry with the detritus of people's furniture and so on. He also repaired cracks in the road and so on. He wants to move from the idea of making art as the creation of new things towards a different sense of creativity based on this aesthetics of repair. And it's really important that these kinds of works are going on because they somehow transmute that kind of the violence of a certain sense of an apocalyptic image to something else, which when you encounter them actually creates a different kind of care, I think. Okay. Sorry to move through it so quickly. So I wanted to just explain what I mean by or where this immanent versus immanent comes from and why I think it's related somehow to the sense of the way I described a hyper object and the state of play at the moment, that kind of ecological destabilized sort of space or feeling. And it came to me first because one of the artists I worked with had described the landscape along the coast afterwards, with television strewn along a bare landscape, and in fact an image which I'll show you in a moment. That's me moving through. This is, I wish I could explain this a bit more too, but it's, you can see behind, we've written over so much, but the image behind which the other artist I worked with, it's a very iconic image of the disaster and quite typical, is of a massive ship that had run aground. And it was, I suppose, interesting that at first, how do you undermine or write through that? And one was to put a lot of text on to try to complicate it. I'll come back. So Kate's description of the landscape was one where it was hard to get away from an idea of beauty or awe in the face of that kind of destruction. But it's not just that. Combined with it is a sense of the deferral of the recognition of reality or of what's really going on, which is part of the confusing nature of the statistics regarding nuclear radiation and the actual physical impacts it might have on your body and on the land. Indeed, it's hard to understand what the implications might be to grasp the geological temporalities of the hundreds and thousands of years which are implicated by it. It's hard to get a sense of a big picture. And although forms of measurement and visualizations of radiation proliferate, even those don't seem real. Geiger counter gauges are uncertain. They're contested. Nevertheless, daily life continues, as one critic wrote, lived by rote amidst accumulating data that must be measured but whose significance is deferred and opaque at best, leaving us years later with an ongoing disaster and a swirling, affective environmental environment of stupefaction, confusion, and impotence. Unable to grasp what it really means in the end, that sublime escapes us. So the root of apocalypse, of course, is in the Greek apocalypsis, which is a kind of unveiling, in fact, or a revelation. And the sublime is generally understood as primarily an aesthetic experience, a sense of wonder or awe, an experience in which the subject is speechless in the face of natural beauty or some indescribable power or event. And as you'll all know, the notion of the sublime has a long history, though there are two dominant theories which date back to the 18th century from Kant, from Burke and then Kant. And indeed, by the time Burke published his treatise on the sublime and the beautiful in 1757, it was already common as an idea. That idea is, or Burke's idea is that the sublime is opposed to the beautiful. The sublime then is allowed to take on more fearful connotations. He says, whatever is in any sort terrible or in conversant about terrible subjects or operates in a manner analogous to terror, that is the source of the sublime. And it partly relocates that in the body as a kind of a feeling. Kant, in his treatment of aesthetics and taste in the Critique of Judgment, a bit later on in 1790, offers a slightly more complex analysis, conceiving it as a strangely seductive experience or a confrontation with the infinite. He introduces two further aspects, and these are important, I suppose, to mine: the destabilization of the subject and the role of pleasure, specifically what he calls a negative pleasure, even a respect. More recent versions of the sublime are linked to the fear of nuclear annihilation specifically. Theorists often now follow Francis Fergusson's important articulation, a description of the nuclear as the unthinkable, which in fact draws on much earlier versions of the sublime, like Longinus, which is revisited and revitalized in recent speculative revisions of the sublime. I want to kind of give a, rather than a kind of literary or cultural definition of it, right now it's being used a lot in environmental art and in art practice and criticism, and indeed it's become quite an all-encompassing term. There's a toxic sublime, a technological sublime, and so on. And there was a big exhibition recently at the Pompidou Metz, and one reviewer describes it as a giant umbrella covering anything vaguely related to the deteriorating state of the environment. So there are reasons to be cautious, I think. And I want to explore a particular form of this, which I think is useful in shifting our understandings. And a part of the argument is that the plethora of apocalyptic images or representations is locked into a kind of sense of the spectacular. And indeed, there's a different distinction, which originally made by Frank Kermode, who's a literary theorist, between imminent and imminent. Traditional discourses are grounded in the belief that that resolution is impending, this imminent apocalypse. In contradistinction, he describes the emergence of a new kind of discourse, one that denies a sense of resolution or of final ends, an immanent apocalypse that operates as if the end were already present. This is not about denying the experience of endings, but redefining them. And of course, there are widely divergent conceptions and interpretations of immanence, which I can't go into here, both formally and ontologically. It is a very ancient and well-travelled notion. Psychoanalysis offers particular examples about the constant negotiation of new associations, of becomings. But what's key really is that that sense of resolution is denied. For Deleuze, there's nothing substantial about it. It's something that one does, something that is demonstrated. And I suppose in the Japanese context, it's to try to understand the sense of the disorientating state of constant transition without an intelligible relation to the past or a predictable relation to the future. It is about ambivalence and confusion, but it's also about coming to terms with that. And in my longer paper, I talk about a Japanese idea of gamansuru, which is the endurance or the staying with. And for me, it's very important in redefining or reconfiguring our understandings of ecology that we accept the kind of a dark ecology, which for me explicitly means being connected to and implicit and complicit within a larger ecology. I could explain that and how it affected different practices, for example, the practice of Ikebana, making and remaking, a practice of consolation, of staying with. And working alongside artists in different modes, in different ways in Japan and elsewhere, this interest in, practicing a particular ethical sensibility, which acknowledges that, both of failure and dysfunction, that complicity within ecology, which I understand is the condition things are in, is really an important part of opening up conversations for me. My own approach theoretically also connects to philosophy of science, specifically Isabel Stenger's, which is about situating knowledge making in terms of its an ecology of practices, which means its effects for other communities, both human and non-human, and this kind of complex and entangled coexistence that implicates everyone and everything, resisting an assumed neutrality or distancing, I suppose. And I think it's not necessarily a fatalistic position to admit that the disaster has already happened or that we're in it. It's rather a position from which to begin that acknowledges a kind of radical interconnectedness in order to act accordingly. And I think that has important implications for the reciprocal nature of anthropological work too, and the ways in which I approach working with materials and people. I understand, following Tim and others, in terms of correspondence, conversation and translation. For me, it means incorporating not only other people as the subjects, of this intersubjective anthropological praxis, but also the materials and forces that we work alongside. Something's happening with the computer, but I'll pretend I don't see it. Hopefully that's okay. So that was a poster for the first exhibition that I did, not designed by me. There were radio interviews. There was translation issues. I worked in a gallery in this first exhibition every day. There was an installation. I was producing prints every day. I was responding to my own work and to conversations with others in a kind of complex. This is a snowdrop, which I used to make cyanotype prints. And I'll move through it very quickly. I exposed them to natural light, using the same materials every day as they continually went through processes of decay and decomposition. I washed after I made my cyano. And this is an example of part of the final one, the last day, a large print that I made. They're made from Prussian blue. And I used it partly because Prussian blue is said to absorb radiation, or specifically cesium-137 from the soil. This is a detail from exactly that. And I hung them, dried them, displayed them over the course of a couple of weeks. And I think that's probably all I can say.